Joe Biden talks tough on Vladimir Putin in his State of the Union address. The U.S. president warning the Russian leader has no idea what's coming. But beyond threats and sanctions, what can the U.S. do to stop Russia's actions on Ukraine? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Hazem Seeker. It is traditionally the most widely viewed speech an American president makes, the annual State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress, laying down the president's plans for the coming year. But events overseas often overshadow those plans and force a rethink. And in this address, Biden's first as president, the conflict unfolding in Ukraine featured heavily in its opening minutes. It was a recognition that the U.S. president was speaking to the world this time and not just the American people. Joe Biden added the United States to the long list of countries barring their airspace to Russian planes. He went after Vladimir Putin over Russia's attack on Ukraine, framing the debate as a battle between democracy and autocracy.
Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, he met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people. The United States Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Our Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has been reacting to the Western response to his country's invasion of its neighbor. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Lavrov said Moscow would not let Ukraine obtain nuclear weapons, and he warned if a third world war took place, it would be nuclear and destructive. Lavrov says Russia would face real danger if Kiev acquired nuclear warheads. Well, in Ukraine, fighting has intensified in and around the Crimean Peninsula that Russia annexed in 2014. Northeast in the city of Kherson, Russian troops and tanks are reportedly in control of the city center. And Ukrainian soldiers say they've been surrounded in the port city of Mariupol, northwest of Crimea. Reports also suggest Russian forces have installed checkpoints around the peninsula. The Ukrainian government has dismissed some of those reports as propaganda. So let's talk about all of this now with our guests in Michigan. I'm joined by Aaron Call, Director of Debate at the University of Michigan. He's also editor and co-author of The State of the Union Is Memorable Addresses of the Last 60 Years. In Kiev is Kira Rudik, a Ukrainian member of parliament, and joining us from Washington, Robert Hunter, former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Warm welcome to all of you. So, Aaron, let me start with you then. What did you make of the president's speech and what he had said about Ukraine? Was it enough?
I think it was probably a little less than some were expecting. You know, it's only an hour speech. And so, and he has a lot of things to talk about, including domestic issues like the economy, inflation, and COVID. It ended up being about the first 10 minutes of the speech, about 15%. But in some ways, it was the zenith of the speech because there was a lot of bipartisan support for the position, a lot of positive imagery, you know, those with the colors of Ukraine, the ambassador was there and, you know, directly talked about. But I think it's a very tough position for him to be in. I look back to, you know, Jimmy Carter's State of the Union address in 1980 after the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan. And he kind of went back to that invasion at several points in the speech, but President Biden chose to just talk about it at the top for 10 minutes. And it's good because that's the time that most of the people are tuned in, and it's the height But I think there was some expectation before that even more time would be devoted, given the significance of the issue and how it's dominating the domestic and international media scene.
Kira Rudik, joining us from Kiev, and we appreciate you joining us from the Ukrainian capital, and we hope you're staying safe there. What did you take from the American president's speech? Was it enough for you?
There is one key point that all Ukrainians are waiting for, is if our allies are going to close the sky for us or not. This is the main thing. This is what we are really looking forward to. We don't really care if it will be official or unofficial, if it will be along with the rules of NATO, or it will be the way that Russia is doing it, saying it was not us. Every single day, Ukrainian cities are being bombarded by Russian missiles. Every single day when we are talking and discussing and negotiating and thinking what else can be done, Ukrainian people are telling what can be done. We need a no-fly zone over Ukraine, or at least some of Ukrainian cities, because every single day, the only matter for us to lose, the only one, is that if Putin will be able to polish Ukrainian soil from the sky. We are doing very well on the land side. We definitely will be able to push back, and we definitely will be able to win. But before that, there is a high chance that Putin will destroy all our cities and destroy our infrastructure the way that we will be thrown back to 20, 30 years behind. And this is so frustrating right now. I'm thankful to the U.S. president for all the support and all the sanctions and all the direction that he have given the world community on how to help Ukraine. However, what we are expecting right now is by any means help us to protect us from the skies. For the last 7 days of war, we have experienced maybe 20 times when there were missile attacks on Kiev. And you have seen the destruction that have happened. And you have seen that right now Putin is using forbidden weaponry, and he even is not hiding it. So given all of that, we have the country that are obeying the rules and saying, okay, we will figure it out, give us some time. And we have a tyrant who is trying to destroy Ukraine with no rules of war, with no rules of war crimes, with no rules of using weapons. And the world is watching and saying, we will help you out, guys, just hold on. So we are holding on, we are pushing back, but what if we fail? And I'm so concerned, given what we have seen in Kharkiv, given what we have seen around Kiev, that we may fail, not because we did wrong, not because we didn't fight enough, not because we didn't have enough soldiers, not because we weren't brave enough, not because we didn't have enough weaponry, but just because from the sky, from the air side, we didn't have the protection that we need so badly right now. So I'm asking every single government in every single country to try and find a way to support Ukraine and provide it with no-fly zone right now over our cities. This is where we ask you from the bottom of our hearts, protect us. We are in the same side, on the same side in this battle. It's not between Russia and Ukraine. It's not between the countries right now. It's in between the civilizations. I know, and we are here on the same side.
Kira, you talk a lot about the no-fly zone there, and I know that is something that many Ukrainians have been calling for, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to ask Robert Hunter what you took from this speech, and did it leave you with questions about where America goes next?
Well, it's interesting, the reference to the Jimmy Carter speech in 1980 after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, because I wrote that speech for Jimmy Carter, and it does bring back haunting memories. Mr. Biden last night did a couple of things. Number one, he was not going to negotiate on television, and negotiations are what are going to happen at this point. China apparently made an offer, and we will see. But Mr. Biden secondly ruled out any U.S. direct military involvement, and that involves a no-fly zone. The United States is not prepared to get involved. Ukraine is not a NATO member, even though it did say and has said for 14 years that Ukraine will join NATO. which creates a moral responsibility, nothing else. He also, however, tried to demonstrate the support, not just of the United States morally and politically on this, as a guest from Michigan said, the bipartisan support, but also to emphasize that Mr. Putin is totally isolated in the outside world. It has been, I think, quite a successful effort with all of the allies, a lot of other countries, to get the most intense sanctions that have ever been imposed. But one has to be realistic, and despite all the fact that what the member of parliament says, what the courage of the Ukrainian people, sanctions I don't think are going to work, certainly not in the short term, unless for some reason Mr. Putin decides he wants to stop, or there's something he wants that can legitimately be worked out with Russia. I'm afraid this is going to become a lot worse. And the United States, as Mr. Biden made clear last night, is going to provide money and weapons, but it is not going to get engaged in the war in any way.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the possibility of a no-fly zone. Aaron Kaur, if NATO were to enforce a no-fly zone over Ukraine, as many Ukrainians are asking for, is that a viable option at this point? And if not, why?
Right. I mean, not from my perspective, kind of, you know, giving the read of what it looks like politically. There have been, you know, interviews. I saw there was an interview with Florida Senator Marco Rubio and just said he thought that if that happened, you know, that it could trigger World War III. You know, because once that occurs, they're, you know, guaranteed to be conflict, and that escalates the United States' involvement and culpability in the conflict. And you know, where the endpoint is, you know, nobody would know. And as the ambassador said, you know, kind of, I think that President Biden was very clear in his speech that there's not going to be U.S. military involvement directly. And I think that would include the no-fly zone. So just like some of his comments about sanction and military and financial other support, banning Russian planes from United States airspace, going after, you know, oligarchs and ill-gotten gains and things like that with the Justice Department, while all those things receive bipartisan support, the exact converse is true of when talking about a no-fly zone. There doesn't seem to be any domestic political support on either side of the aisle, and including the president, of this no-fly zone, because of the potential for escalation in that conflict. So that doesn't seem likely, absent some major change in the situation.
Well, let's put that to Kira Rudick then. You talked earlier about the need for a no-fly zone, but the concern that NATO has over that is that it would escalate this war to a level that it doesn't, to somewhere that it doesn't want to go, because it would mean fighting the Russian military directly, and that could escalate into a much wider war, which could be worse, not just for Ukrainians, but for many more people in Europe. What do you say to that?
So, first of all, I totally understand that, because I'm a politician myself. But I'm also sure that if there are rules that exist, and we are talking about the rules that the NATO members only have to protect NATO members, there are ways to go over those rules. And Afghanistan was not a NATO member. And Syria was not a NATO member, right? And right now we are talking about a European country that needs support. And I'm sure, and I have been talking to different generals from different European countries, and this is right now one of the ways that everybody is discussing the way that will allow not to get into the bigger conflict politically, but that will provide us with the enough support from the air. This is basically the goal. This is basically the task. I don't see it as the one being impossible, especially that we have seen Putin, who for 8 years was declining that his army is on our territory and that his army is in Ukrainian Donbas. So there could be a document put together, and I know that some U.S. officials are working on it right now, that would say with certain limitations and with certain items and only for the protection purposes here and there, we can help and support for these particular reasons. And I'm sure, and I'm super convinced that at some point it will get to that. My issue is that we see that all the steps that the democratic countries are taking, they are like 2 weeks late than Putin's actions. And we as Ukrainians are paying for it with our lives and with our blood. Because the sanctions were in, which we are super grateful for, I want to be super honest, we are very grateful for them. The sanctions were put on Friday. So the first day when the Russians started feeling it was Monday. So the 3 days we had to die to and fight, and the, because it was just the time issue. So if everybody in their hearts will agree that the protection will be implemented, then we need to make sure that it will be implemented as fast as possible. If we in our hearts do not agree that it will happen, then I want to be very open with everybody, and I'm very open with it, that there is a chance that Ukraine may fail. We'll be fighting as hell. We will be protecting our country. But at some point, given what is happening right now, we may not be able to. And okay, then there will be a question for everybody about, like, what are we going to do with the country that is occupied by Russia in the center of Europe? And if the solution to protect the country while we are independent and fighting was better than having another country,
all right,
with
well,
the puppet marionette.
Let's put some of that. Let's put some of that to. Let's put some of that to Robert Hunter. Then, what happens if all of these measures that the United States and its allies have taken don't make any difference and fail to force Putin into retreat, and Ukraine is essentially an occupied country? And, you know, dare I ask, if he keeps going beyond that, determined to reestablish this kind of sphere of influence that the old Soviet Union's leaders gave up disastrously in Vladimir Putin's view. What happens then?
Well, first, I think the Russians are calculating that they're prepared to take more risks in order to subjugate, and that's the word we're talking about, Ukraine, than the United States, in particular as the leader of the NATO alliance, is prepared to run. And that game of threatened escalation, Mr. Putin has already demonstrated that he has succeeded at that. And the United States and the other NATO allies have said it is not worth risking escalation, maybe even to the nuclear level, for Ukraine. That, unfortunately, is a fact, a harsh reality. If indeed Mr. Putin decides to move forward to occupy all of Ukraine, and in the short term, sanctions aren't going to work. Sanctions will isolate and maybe even destroy the Russian economy over years, but it's not going to work right now. But if that happens, then we'll see what Mr. Putin's prepared to do. I believe there is already a tacit understanding, and this is a harsh reality, that Mr. Putin is going to be able to get away with whatever he wants to do in Ukraine at pain and suffering of the Ukrainian people, who are being extraordinarily brave. And quite frankly, the only reason I suspect that Mr. Putin hasn't already gone throughout the country is that, at least in the pain of Russians being killed, inadequacy of Russian forces. But the tacit understanding is, yes, and I'm going to say this is the way it would sound to an outside observer, yes, you can have Ukraine, that's too bad, but you're not going to be allowed to touch any of the NATO allies, at least with open aggression. And I think Mr. Putin understands that and is prepared to respect it, because Mr. Biden has been very clear, and this he can't back down from. If there was open aggression against any NATO ally, the United States would have to respond, or NATO's finished and America's European power is finished. And I think Putin understands that. But Ukraine, I won't say being sacrificed, but I'm afraid unless Mr. Putin decides to stop, at some point, Ukraine is going to suffer a lot more and will be
all right,
occupied.
Aaron Cole, what's your take on that? That as terrible a toll as this is taking on Ukraine, the U.S. and its allies, would not be prepared to go any further than what they're doing now, the much beyond what they're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, some other things that have been discussed that are short of the no-fly zone. I mean, Senator Joe Manchin has called for a ban on Russian oil exports. There's talk about taking action against Russia inside of the United Nations Security Council. I mean, some of the proposals were just, you know, debuted last night about the banning of Russian planes in airspace and emboldening the Department of Justice to go after oligarchs. And that stuff is tough. I mean, they're, you know, the wealth is intertwined in a lot of different areas, such as, you know, real estate, professional sports groups and things like that. So yes, it's a very timely thing. And people are talking about, we're just, you know, 1 week into this, but people are already talking about, you know, something that lasting months or years. And so, yes, I mean, eventually if President Putin goes too far, or, you know, troops from NATO or people from NATO and other countries kind of become involved, then that may tie the United States' hands. But we certainly don't know the future, and this just may be the beginning. But yes, in the short term, just the daily, you know, suffering, the horrendous actions occurring is likely to occur, and that'll drive the policies. Things we think about right now that may not be possible. It's unclear, given how things escalate and what kind of the appetite of both the American public and the world that's watching this and the media landscape is. And nobody knows the answer to that as of now.
Keira Rudyk, I'm probably going to give you what's probably going to be the last word on this to you. And I want to ask you as well, should the West have seen this coming?
First of all, I have a comment about it. That will happen, and we'll have to suffer. The point is, we definitely do understand what's going on right now, like in the world politics, and how Ukraine is as a country. We are receiving support from one side, but we know that the most of the work we will have to do ourselves. There is no doubt to that. But again, when you are calculating and weighing the risks, the issue would be like, what would happen if there will be a Russia-controlled country, large country with huge potential and gas pipes and Chernobyl on its territory in the center of Ukraine. And it will be, and instead of having the country that is fighting for its freedom, fighting for European Union, it will be a country who will be like producing additional Russian soldiers. Are we sure that this is like the world wants? Because if so, like it's easy and quickly to go to that. Then second thing is, should the West see him coming? Well, Putin was very, very, very adamant about what he is going to do. And it started, I think I was in the United States for early November when this information was shared that he's going to attack. And since that time, so it was not news. Since that time, Ukraine has been at the pre-war situation, and everybody was expecting this because we all had intelligence. We all had information that he is gathering the troops. We had high hope that he wouldn't attack, but the understanding was there. A week before war, I was at the Munich Security Conference. And there I was talking to members of different governments and with the military representatives, etc. And everybody was saying, yeah, we think the chance is less than 10%. And my reply to that was, okay, if the chance is less than 10%, if you have the list of sanctions, please show them to him right now so he would know what he's playing against. And for various reasons, it didn't happen. So I think we all were too optimistic about what he is going or not going to do. I think that was a mistake from the overall democratic idea of, he will think about citizens that are going to be getting killed, etc. A person, as a political leader here in Ukraine, who has been at war with Putin for 8 years, I can tell you he's crazy, he's unpredictable,
okay.
And we should not anticipate logical decisions on his side. We need to keep it in mind.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you to all three of you Aaron Kaur in Michigan, Kia Rudick in Kiev, and Robert Hunter in Washington. Thanks very much for being on Inside Story. And thank you, as always, for watching. You can see this program again anytime. Just go to our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hazem Sika, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.